Ready to proceed when you are, and you're Mr. Well, go ahead.
I was going to say, members of the Honorable Court Counsel, I'm John Chickalala, registration number 2011. I represent Samantha Lee, previously known as Samantha Morton. This appeal out of the divorce case surrounds three financial issues which are inextricably woven. In the trial court, Ms. Morton presented unrebutted testimony and written evidence that during the course of the marriage, three loans were taken out to further her education. Three groups of loans, if I can use that phrase. The first set of loans were Stafford loans for her to go to with the consent of the husband after discussion. RT, or radiological technician school, I'll use RT for short, so RT school, so that she could become what's commonly known as an x-ray technician. Those loans were taken out in the maximum amount by agreement of the parties, because during that period of time, Ms. Morton would not be attending work, she'd be attending school full time. The loans consisted of two basic components. The first component was to pay tuition and fees, which was the smaller of the components by about 25%. The other component was a full living subsidy portion of the loan, which was paid to the parties to assist in their living expenses while she was unemployed and attending school full time.
And were these Stafford loans incurred prior to the entry of the dissolution of decree in this proceeding?
They were, and they were incurred well prior to the separation of the parties or any recognition by the parties that the marriage was at risk or had ruptured. Occurred approximately 2 years, if I recall correctly, prior to the filing of the dissolution of marriage.
And what was, you said there were two components of the Stafford loans. What did they amount to?
That particular block of loans amounted to approximately $16,000. So that approximately $12,000 of the Stafford loans was for subsistence or living expenses. That portion was paid by warrants through the Colorado State Treasury and directly to Ms. Lee. And then she endorsed those warrants and deposited them into the joint marital account, which was used as, I'll call the operating account for the parties, and was spent for marital expenses. Before the marital rupture, the parties had agreed that based upon her experiences at RT school, that she could benefit from going to further education in sonography. Sonography is the study of ultrasounds and doing ultrasounds, such as we most frequently see on prenatal care, where an ultrasound is done in order to view the inside of the body for the health of the baby, but it can be done for other purposes, such as determining the health of the patient, find aneurysms and the like. That agreement was made during the marriage and prior to the rupture of marriage. However, it was agreed that between RT school and the sonogram school, Ms. Morton would work to help try to pay off some bills. And she applied for and was admitted to the American Institute for Sonography. It may contain other aspects, but at least that's where she went to sonography school. And then the marriage ruptured.
And what was the amount of the sonography loans?
The amount of the basic sonography loan was another $16,000. However, there was a side note where the loans did not cover the full tuition. It was taken through TCF or TFC, a loan for students to complete their education. There's a bank similarly known in Colorado, but it wasn't through that bank. It's a separate institution for student loans of about $6,000.
What was the total amount from the loans that was used for general marital purposes as opposed to specifically paying the tuition?
Approximately $12,000, and they only occurred in that initial block of the initial Stafford loans, where about 25% went to tuition and fees, and the other 75% went to household living expenses as a subsidy. The second block, if I can use that phrase, contained no subsidy. Sonomogram School was more expensive than it just paid for the tuition and is insufficient to meet that. So a second loan was taken out by Ms. Lee through the TCF fund to pay for the added tuition and fees.
Mr. Ciccolo, does it make any difference at all that some of the loans were used for living expenses and some of them were used for actual school expenses?
Well, I think that's key to our position on appeal. Because the loans were used, the 12,000 loans were used for living expenses, the court excluded that through an error in either listening at trial or simply misunderstanding the trial evidence. But the exhibits that were presented, which included the warrants and the bank statements that showed that those $12,000 that came in three installments went into the joint account and were therefore spent, were not considered by the court as a marital expense. The court found that the entirety of the loans, the two major blocks of approximately $16,000 apiece, plus the TCF loans, were all acquired after the marriage and therefore went to the benefit of Ms. Lee, Ms. Morton at the time. And so what we have presented to the court is that the trial court erred in not considering that portion of the Stafford loans that went to marital living expenses, and then gave that entire $12,000 in effect debt to Ms. Morton.
You said that the court found that the loans were all incurred after the marriage. Did you mean after the separation? I think that's what the court said. The court said...
Yes, I'm sorry, because some of the grant school incurred after separation, so I correct myself there.
But these loans were incurred during the marriage.
$16,000.
Prior to the decree dissolving the marriage.
And prior to the rupture of the marriage. So there was a gap in which she went to RT school and the parties continued to live together in order to try to bring their finances up. And then Ms. Morton was accepted to Sonogram School during the marriage, but she started following the rupture of the marriage.
But in terms of determining whether or not it's a marital debt, does the separation or rupture have anything to do with it? I thought if it's during the term or the course of the marriage and before the decree of dissolution entered, it's a marital debt. Is that not right?
That's our position. And as a matter of fact, not only that marital portion of the Stafford loan was a marital debt, but also that portion of the loan went to tuition was a marital debt. Likewise, with the loan that was agreed upon that the parties would take out, and Ms. Morton didn't begin the school until after separation, but had committed to the education and had been accepted for the education during the marriage, that was a debt that was incurred during the marriage and prior to the decree. At the time of the final orders hearing, Ms. Morton had been in Sonogram School for approximately a year with another 6 or 7 months to go before completion.
Mr. Ciccolo, although you haven't gotten to this issue yet, I wanted to ask you, since the time is running somewhat low, about your contention that the trial court erred in determining maintenance before dividing the marital property.
Yes, there is a case, and quite frankly, I don't have it on the tip of my tongue, but it's in the brief, in which a division of this court found that I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought. Would you repeat that, Your Honor?
I think you're referring to a case where the court addressed the issue of the division of marital property as opposed to maintenance.
Yes,
the timing of that.
And thank you. In order to determine the amount of maintenance that has to be or should be award it to an individual, the court must be able to recognize and know what the assets are that the party is to receive and what proportion of debts the party is going to pay. By making a determination with regard to maintenance before looking at the amount of property and the amount of debt that Ms. Morton would receive, the trial court put the cart before the horse and determined maintenance without knowing whether or not she would have sufficient property or be so encumbered by debt or she could not make or sustain herself on the amount of spousal maintenance that was awarded.
But wasn't that cured on the post-trial motions when the court said, I did consider it? I mean, isn't that kind of mooted by that?
Well, the trial court said that, but if you look at the trial court's closing comments when we immediately afterwards, it was clear that the court really didn't know what she was going to do with regard to property and debt, because when I inquired as to whether or not I could still file my bill of particulars with regard to attorney's fees, the court and I had a little colloquy about that, and the court concluded by saying, well, I still have to decide property, debt, and attorney's fees. So it was clear that the court hadn't reached a decision on that point, and that further she took it under advisement and was going to issue a ruling with regard to that, a written ruling. I can't jump into the mind of the trial court's head, but it certainly appeared that she had put the cart before the horse. And I'm not too sure she did so in any sort of malicious way. I think she said, I've got to deal with several issues. I think I can deal with maintenance first, and simply did so without a critical analysis of the other points that she has to look at in order to make a determination of the amount and duration of spousal maintenance. In this case, we're not challenging the duration of spousal maintenance. School was to go on for another 6 or 7 months, and the trial court said that I'm going to give a couple of months for her to find a job and get established before spousal maintenance end.
Could you address this question of whether or not proceeds from a loan can be considered as income or resources to a party to then determine the issues of maintenance and property division?
Certainly, and I, as I noted in my brief, I could find no Colorado case on point, and quite frankly, I didn't do a national search. However, by reading the statute and the cases that are out there, I think it's an obvious conclusion that if you do not have to dissipate your assets in order to qualify for spousal maintenance, then the logic as it would continue would say you don't have to incur debt in order to vitiate the need for spousal maintenance. Spousal maintenance is intended to provide for the support of an individual post-decree for a period of time until they can get themselves back on their feet. By saying, as I put in my brief, as the judge did, gee, you've got loan money you can go borrow, is tantamount to saying you've got a credit card. Go use your Visa card and buy groceries. A Visa card doesn't substitute for spousal maintenance and the need for spousal maintenance. It merely points out the actual need that there has to be some money other than the accumulation of debt or loss of property. And I'm going to jump real quick because I only have a minute 45. I'm going to jump real quick to the attorney's fees issue. In my brief, I left as an issue that we were seeking attorney's fees on appeal, but as counsel noted, there was no argument in that in my brief. As I wrote the brief, I found that I couldn't sustain a request for attorney's fees on appeal, so I removed that argument from my brief and in error neglected to remove it as an issue in the front of the brief. So I apologize for any confusion that may have caused. But we are seeking to be able to go to the trial court and present our request for attorney's fees in our case in chief. And during the trial, which we were time limited on, I made a very brief summary set of questions with my client as to whether or not there were fees, whether or not she had to borrow for fees, whether or not she could afford those fees, and received answers that would indicate that she could not afford the fees, had to borrow the fees. And we asked the court for leave to submit those fees under Rule 121 under a bill of costs. When that request was made, there was no objection made, and the court didn't shake her head no or give an affirmative answer. Probably the best practice would have been to have said, gee, judge, can I have a ruling on that? In my closing argument, I reiterated that request, and as the court noted, and I just noted at the end of my colloquy, it was brought up again. Mr. Morton has raised the issue that I did not timely preserve that issue. I believe it was preserved, and I believe the way it was presented, it was assumed, and certainly assumed by me and perhaps wrongly, that issue could be presented by way of the voting papers. I notice I have a red light. I appreciate the court's consideration.
Let me ask you one question,
yes, sir.
Do I understand you correctly that you say that you have withdrawn or you are withdrawing your request for appellate attorney fees?
That's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If it please the court and counsel, my name is Melanie Douglas, bar number 26958. I represent the appellee, Cody Morton, in this case. I don't believe in Mr. Ciccolillo's argument that he brought up anything new that hasn't already been fully briefed in each of our briefs. However, I would like to address just briefly a few of the comments that he made. First of all, the evidence regarding the loans. Ms. Morton testified very clearly that her new education costs were about $33,000. The total education costs listed in her financial affidavit when we went to the trial were about $39,000. My client testified that there was about $6,000 left in school loans when the parties separated. I agree with the court that it would all be considered marital debt because it was all accumulated during the marriage, whether it was pre-separation or post-separation. However, the trial court has very clear discretion to determine that those loans benefited only Mrs. Morton, benefited her future, and that she should therefore be responsible to repay those loans.
So are you saying that the trial court did err in characterizing some of those loans as non-marital debt?
I believe, I don't know if she said it as non-marital. I think what she said is that they were accumulated significantly past the separation date. I don't agree that that makes any difference, and I don't think she saw it as non-marital. I think she saw it as a huge amount of debt that was accumulated post-separation.
But how do we know? I mean, if the judge incorrectly characterized some of the debt as non-marital, mm-hmm. I think you're saying that's wrong because it was prior to the entry of the decree. Then you're saying, but the judge had all this vast discretion to allocate the debt. But how do we know that the judge would have allocated the debt in the same manner if she had correctly determined that it was in fact marital debt in the first place?
I do think that she clarified in her order and in the record that she was talking about post-separation debt and pre-separation debt. I think she was very clear that her order was based on the fact that the loans were solely benefiting Mrs. Morton.
How do you explain the court's order wherein the court says wife is responsible for these loans as her separate debt?
I think that's her order, that she's ordering it to be separate debt. I don't think she's saying that it was non-marital debt. I think she's ordering that because it benefited wife, which is very common in the family law arena, if one party or the other has debt that benefits them only in their education capacity, that debt would be awarded to them. I don't read it the same way the court is reading. I think she's saying this is going to be her separate debt because of the way that it was accumulated and what it was accumulated for.
Ms. Douglas, I'm concerned a little bit about the procedures that Judge Groves used here. Even if what you say is correct, doesn't the statute require that the court first determine the amount of all marital property and debt, and then determine how it should be allocated?
I think that the court is required to determine the property and debt. Now, are you saying this in reference to the spousal maintenance issue?
No, I'm talking about the division of marital property, which would include the student loans.
Okay.
I don't recall in any of the court's orders seeing any statement saying that here is the total of the marital property that I find that exists, and here is the amount of separate property that exists. Is there such a statement somewhere?
I don't believe there is. However, in all of our financial documents, we never made any assertion, and nor did the court make any, except the one wording that you're talking about. We never made any assertion that these were separate debts. In all of our trial exhibits, both Mr. Ciccolella's and my trial exhibits for our parties, we made it very clear these were the debts that were accumulated during the marriage. So I don't believe that became an issue.
Well, let me ask you a follow-up question, which is the same question I asked Mr. Ciccolella, mm-hmm. or a similar question to what I asked him. How is it, or was it appropriate for the court to determine maintenance before considering the division of marital property, given the statutory requirements of Section 1410.114, subsection 3?
I believe, based also on what Justice Berger stated, in Re Marriage of Jones, 627 P. 2nd 248 is the pivotal case, and it does talk about the fact that the court must consider the property and debt award. And Judge Groves did, in fact, do that. It is very clear from the entire record that these parties did not have much property and did have too much debt. That is very clear. And she was well aware of that when she issued the spousal maintenance award.
But the statute says specifically that the court is supposed to make certain determinations first regarding division of marital property and marital debt, mm-hmm. and also with regard to separate property, before it can make the determinations necessary with regard to an award of maintenance. And that apparently wasn't done here.
As Judge Groves stated in her second post-decree order, she in fact was aware of those things even though the order was not written. By the time she did her second post-decree order, the division of property and debt was in fact finished, and she went through those considerations again. And I do believe that she cured that problem in that second post-decree order. These parties clearly did not have the money for Ms. Morton to do her second education. And by the way, my client strongly, strongly disagrees with the assertion that they agreed that she should go back to school and quit her jobs and put herself in the financial situation that she was in when the divorce occurred. So I think that issue was cured by that second post-decree order, in answer to your question.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Could you also address this question of whether or not a court properly can consider the proceeds of loans when it then determines any entitlement to maintenance?
The most important thing that we argued at the trial court and that the court found was that school loans often are, in fact, partially for support. When you have a student that isn't able to support themselves and go to school, that is part of the issue. And Ms. Morton testified, her own testimony was that her cost in finishing up school was $33,000, and that she had those funds available to her to finish her education.
But you have to pay it back. I mean, why isn't counsel's analogy to the credit card? I mean, would you say if Judge Groves had said, well, she has a $20,000 limit on her MasterCard.
Right.
So I'm going to attribute that she has $20,000 resources because she can use the credit card. You wouldn't stand behind that, would you?
I absolutely would not, but it's very different than a school loan. Most people that go through undergraduate or advanced degrees, unless they are from a very wealthy family, have to take out loans not only for their tuition, but also for their support. But I think she weighed that not only from what was available to Mrs. Morton through those school loans, but also with my client's ability to pay. He's a firefighter. Ms. Morton was able to make $18 or $19 an hour before she took on this additional education.
But that's a isn't that a separate issue? I mean, whether or not your client or the wife should have been charged, if you will, with receiving income resources of the amount of the loan, that's entirely separate from whether or not your client could afford to pay, and if so, in what amount of maintenance, isn't it?
I think those, both of those factors have to be weighed at the same time. But the whole purpose of spousal maintenance is to make sure that that spouse that maybe isn't able to work, and I think that was a big part of the factor. She was perfectly able to work. She chose to do this educational program and take on this additional debt, and she, her earning ability compared to my client's earning ability was very similar. And so I think that was a big part of the consideration, is that she could have easily been earning that money to support herself, maybe done a shorter educational program, do something a little bit different.
But Ms. Douglas, didn't Judge Gross say that the educational opportunities available to Ms. Lee were appropriate?
She did. She did make that finding, but you still have to look at her ability to earn on her own.
Well, but presumably the purpose of education by a spouse is to increase the earning capability of that spouse. Isn't that correct?
That's correct. And the judge did find that she had made a good faith career choice to go back to school.
So are you aware of any reported case in which the court has held that loan proceeds, whether from a school loan or any other kind of loan, can be considered as income for purposes of determining maintenance?
I have not found any case either way, as Mr. Chicolella said.
Do you know if there are any cases outside of Colorado that have addressed that issue?
I have not found anything either way.
But you actually did an all-feds, all-state search?
I did.
And found nothing?
I did not find any cases on point on that issue. So I do think that's a issue of first impression for this court. If the court has nothing else, the only other thing I have to state is that I don't believe that the attorney's fees issue were preserved as an issue at the end of the trial court hearing on Mr. Chicolella's behalf. And so I would ask that the trial court's award of attorney's fees be affirmed. I'd, of course, ask that all of the trial court's orders be affirmed. If there are no further questions.
I do have a question about the attorney's fees. Mr. Chicolella set forth in his brief several instances where he asked the court to allow him an opportunity to submit a bill of court costs. So, and if you're saying that that didn't preserve the issue, what do you think that Mr. Chicolella should have done to preserve the issue?
I actually don't think, and I may be wrong on this issue, but I don't believe he actually stated it in that manner. I think he presumed that he was going to be allowed to send in. And his attorney's fees, prior and according to his client's financial at the time of trial, were the $15,000, just $15,000, apparently borrowed from his client's father. What he submitted after the fact and addressed by Judge Rose in her first post-decree order was a little over $16,000 in attorney's fees. And I think he was just looking to be able to supplement to show the court what the total was. He did that. And she still found that the attorney's fees were appropriate.
Okay.
anything else. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And thank both of you for your fine arguments. And the matter will stand submitted to the court, and an opinion will issue in due course. Oh, I'm sorry. Did I forget rebuttal, Mr.?
My red light hit, Judge, so.
I think so.
I think I covered it all. My red light hit, and if I recall, I was 10 or 12 seconds over.
Okay. Well, I thought that was the case, but certainly could have been.
And if it's not inappropriate, I haven't seen Judge Talbot in about 30 years. And if I can come up and say, it's good to see you again, or at least say that from here. I don't know the other judges. I'm not trying to make a personal appeal to him, but he did practice in the Springs, and it's been a long time. So it's good to see you again.
Nice to see you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that will conclude our 10 o'clock docket. And the court will now be in recess. Counsel are excused, and the bailiff may so announce. Thank you.